I guess I had a question left over, which was, so if I remember correctly, you had a, somehow the representation for an odor was somehow invariant over some range of strength and then somehow went off?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So any ideas to, I mean, because it's sort of strange, either,
uh-huh.
I mean, so like one, like two orders of magnitude that somehow converge
yeah.
the same, and then if you change it by another order of magnitude, mm-hmm. it somehow goes somewhere else.
So when you look at the input patterns, what happens as you increase the concentration yeah. is that you activate those glomeruli that have been activated at the lower concentration more strongly, of course, and then you recruit others.
Okay.
And there are some concentration steps where you suddenly recruit a relatively large number of new glomeruli.
Okay.
And sometimes they are also clustered in a different region. So it's sort of, you have the impression that as you increase concentration, you're not continuously recruiting glomeruli, but there are sometimes
okay.
sudden
the
leaps. And
that somehow further downstream, somehow you
right.
then recover so, back some invariant.
Well, it could be that if you recruit too many new glomeruli at once, that then the previous representation falls apart because you suddenly get inputs to two different sets of glomeruli and you get lateral interactions.
Okay, presumably from a behavioral point of view, it's,
yeah, from
it's
a
still able to, whatever, if you still, it's able to decide this is banana or something. Or
maybe not. So it's actually hard to find good literature, data in the literature on the psychophysics of not just fish, any species. So it has been reported several times in the literature that this invariant recognition of odors holds only over a range of maybe 100 or 1,000-fold concentration changes and then falls apart. But if you try to, you never find references for the statement. So if you try to find any original quantitative data on this, at least I failed.
Okay.
But there's certainly, so there's this out there, and perfumers would say so. But if you ask them, where does it come from? Can you show me a reference? I haven't found anybody who has one. But there are these extreme cases where at some relatively small range in concentration, suddenly the perceived quality changes drastically from something pleasant to something really unpleasant, for example.
Okay.
So that happens.
Okay, so
just exactly how frequent this phenomenon is and how broad the stable range is, I don't really know.
So it's something mm-hmm. which is that might actually have, you know, behavior.
Yeah. We would assume so based on what people say. So in vision, I have not heard of this. So as you increase contrast, for example,
yeah.
or brightness, there's never a change in what you see.
Yeah.
But in olfaction, that's been known. Yeah.
Okay.
I think like more than two orders, like.
No.
It's what you should. Would be compatible with eventually a sort of binary proof, basically an odor is there or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's too much of one odorant or the other, the animal just perceives one, and
mm-hmm.
there's a mixture of the two, there's two.
Mm-hmm.
So the presentation of two might be different from the presentation of each one of them.
Well, yeah, if I mean, with two odors, we can get three states also, if these odors are not too too similar.
That's the three states. It's 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1.
Ah, okay. Ah, that, okay.
Uh-huh. That could be tested by, I mean, like, for example, three order, in which case it's true. Has 1, 0,
that's
0,
true,
0,
yeah.
0, 0, 1.
No, we haven't done that. What we have, but not in the morphing experience, just pure mixture experiments, is to use two complex odors and mix those. So each one of those, so these were food extracts. So each one of those has probably hundreds of different compounds. We found, yeah. So in that case, we found some, basically at the level of glomeruli, it's additive. It's not exactly additive, but each glomerulus has a dose response function. And once you know this, you can reconstruct the superposition. You just go in this dose response function to double the concentration or so, because these are really broad. A factor of two in concentration change is not a lot, usually on that scale. So it's a nice superposition. At the level of mitral cells in binary mixtures with a simple odors, what we found is, I think I said this in response to one of the questions, is that usually one odor dominates over the other. in really the very most cases. So that the response to the mixture looks like the response to one of the two odors alone.
I see. So with the example you showed of the three possible trajectories were for the plumary lamp, but not the mystery. So
that's the three possible.
Okay, so you had this plot where you had two similar odorants.
Uh-huh.
Two dissimilar odorants.
Yeah.
The two dissimilar, you had three possible, more or less three possible endpoints for the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
No, this was for the mitral cells, actually.
This is for mitral cells. Mm-hmm. So in this case, there's no one odor that dominates.
Well, it could be that some of the cells in those patterns respond like odor one and the other cells respond like odor two. And then the pattern as a whole would be somewhere in between.
Oh, I see. So you're saying if you look at individual cells, it looks like they're responding as if there was a single odor in there. And it can be one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the level of the population,
yeah.
Some of them may choose odor A, some of them may choose odor B. And so
right. Yeah.
Like, I see.
Yeah. And when we do this with the complex odors, we do not get this dominance behavior,
uh-huh.
or to a lesser extent. You still see it, but it's not as clear. So there's something more than going on. Small discussion, yeah. Yeah, so it's it's up to you, I would say, to define what we want to do here. So if you have any questions about what I presented this morning, we can go in this a little deeper. Yeah. Otherwise, what I could do is just go on with the talk and show some additional data. Okay. So yeah, what I was basically have next here is to go to the next higher brain areas. And I did not bring in a lot of slides because I tried to keep this short, so feel free to ask any questions. So this morning I talked about the olfactory bulb, and there we found a variety of computations. I emphasized pattern decorrelation and odor classification, which is sort of it's almost the same. So the classification involves the decorrelation. There are other computations that we observe, for example, a volume control. That means that the input, total input to the olfactory bulb can vary over a broad range. As you change concentrations, for example, as you add components to a mixture, you recruit more and more neurons. But the average activity across the output population does not change much. So there's some kind of gain control going on. There's also a multiplexing such that the information conveyed by spikes that synchronize, that phase lock to the local field potential oscillation, and spikes that don't convey different information. Okay, and altogether, it is the representation of all this is still relatively compact because the total number of mitral cells is not very high, 1,500. Yeah. Which ones? The mitral cells. First of all, they are spontaneously active, but that requires low levels of spontaneous activity in the input. So if you shut that down or you just cut the nerve or so, that basically goes to zero. Yes. And otherwise, I would say that there's no peculiar property. So AHPs are not very prominent. No. So the oscillations that we see here in the fish is 20 hertz, so 50 milliseconds, and the AHPs, as far as we can see, do not outlast those. So the membrane time constants. Actually, we have not really measured this for mitral cells. the main reason, many of the obvious things we haven't measured because we are usually recording from them in a regime where they get lots of spontaneous synaptic inputs, and then it's difficult to measure those things. So for, but I would think on the order of 20 milliseconds or so. We have measured this actually for the downstream neurons, which are supposed to read out those, and they have pretty long time constants, 20 to 50 milliseconds or something like that. So not well suited to integrate to for coincidence detection, at least in the one brain area we looked. Nathan Urban. That is something that we have never observed, but there is data in the literature from mouse mitral cells that I believe, and that was done in slices where the cells are silent and you depolarize them, and then within a range of membrane potentials you sometimes see them spontaneously oscillating. But if you then present any kind of external synaptic input, it would reset this, and the input would basically override the internal tendency to oscillate. So I believe that if our cells show any of this behavior, we would not see it because they get synaptic input all the time. It could be that our cells have it and that this helps to entrain them in some kind of oscillation, but in fact we don't know. So we have never seen it, but it may be because we are always in this regime of high synaptic input. Some in rats, I think, this was done, but they are morphologically quite different from our cells. So they are the mitral cell body is quite remote from the dendritic tuft where the sensory input comes in, so from the glomerulus. Because there's this thick external plexiform layer in between. And this dendrite that connects the soma to this dendritic tuft is almost like an axon. Very, very thin, it's partially even myelinated. And in this mitral cell, people found that you can actually evoke action potentials at the apical tuft or at the soma. The threshold is lower at the soma, but under some conditions you can actually evoke the action potential out in the tuft first, before, and then it travels to the soma. That's true. Our cells, I don't think that. I would be very surprised if they have it because everything is so much smaller. They are morphologically quite different. It would be surprising.
Yeah.
Pardon?
44 out of 150.
I just so just for you to see, this is just a segment of spontaneous activity of a mitral cell. Well, the subthreshold synaptic activity would still be there,
but.
Oh yeah, that's synaptic activity. Sure. When you block synaptic inputs, then the cell is completely flat. Okay. So from what we know about the olfactory bulb, we basically think it's a pre-processing device, and so it's not the place where odor memories are laid down, or where decisions are made or anything. But it could be just a pre-processing device. For higher brain areas to work with these representations more easily, so therefore we wanted to go to higher representations and also look at how these patterns are read out. Because if you don't know the strategies by which the patterns are read, it doesn't make too much sense to actually speculate about the function of these computations. So. There are many different downstream areas. One is olfactory cortex in mammals, of course, but besides that, there are many other cortical and also subcortical areas. And in zebrafish, we have homologs of these areas, although the cytoarchitecture is often quite a bit different. And we focused on one area that is homologous to olfactory cortex, and that is called, just called DP, posterior zone of the dorsal telencephalic area, and started to just take an open mind and look at what's happening there. There were two hypotheses out there what this area could do. One is pattern storage. This is something that we are quite interested in, but we haven't gotten so far yet. So basically, the architecture suggests that this could function, olfactory cortex could function as an auto-associative network and store patterns. The other one, other hypothesis is that this could have something to do with object representations. And this is because within the olfactory bulb, you do not have convergence, excitatory convergence of glomerular processing channels, but you basically have only inhibition between those channels. So therefore, in some, it has been thought that at some stage, those channels have to converge in various combinations in order to get the neurons that respond to particular combinations of features. Okay, object representation. So in the visual system, you can represent objects, but you can still segment them into their individual components, line segments. In olfaction, this is usually believed not to be true. So you can smell this combination of molecules here as a jasmine odor, but you cannot tell, this is a mixture of this and this and this and this individual odorant. So therefore, those object representations may be different, generated differently, more synthetic, as people say, than in other sensory systems. And okay, so this would be a circuit diagram, textbook diagram, basically, of olfactory cortex. So there's a prominent recurrent excitatory connectivity. There's feedforward and feedback inhibition. And the inputs coming in here could now target neurons in a way so that individual neurons receive input from multiple glomeruli. And basically, all of this is true. And hard evidence for this really came only from very recent experiments. So to see if in the zebrafish we have a similar architecture, we did a bunch of experiments. I'm just showing you one data slide. So here we just stimulated the olfactory tract, the inputs, and recorded from the neurons in this area. And then we see a short latency input currents, excitatory currents, and also currents coming in at later latency. So we ascribe those to the direct inputs and then to the polysynaptic recurrent excitatory inputs in the network. And then as we go to when we clamp the cell at 0 millivolts to look at inhibitory inputs, what we see is first of all those inhibitory input is usually very large. And second, it is also quite slow. And it's always disynaptic or polysynaptic. So that is consistent with this scheme. And then we did more experiments as well, including paired recordings within this area to see that so far what we found is quite consistent with this circuit diagram here. Okay, so then we looked at responses to odors and first chose our odors to look at topographic representations. Yeah. At the what? The balance? I'll come to that, yeah. So then we chose two families of odors that we know activate sort of opposite areas in the olfactory bulb with very little overlap. So this is now looking at the mitral cell responses to these odors in the olfactory bulb. So these are amino acids, and they usually activate, or always actually activate, the lateral bulb predominantly. Bile acids activate the opposite part. This is the overlay, and then you can see that there's a pretty clear spatial segregation of responses to these two odor classes. And that is really a robust finding. So that is seen at the level of mitral cells and glomeruli. And then we looked at
Are they virtually this. Always clustered?
What is always clustered? The
response.
There is here we are actually looking at a over a very large area. So this is basically the entire dorsal ventral hemisphere of the olfactory bulb. And those responses here to amino acids and bile acids are always segregated from each other. But in between those cells that are active here, you will have many cells that are not active, actually. So there's not a tight clustering on a next neighbor basis. OK, so this is just a volume representation. And then we used the same orders, repeated this experiment in the cortical area, DP. And then we see that the responses are basically intermingled to those two order classes. And there's very little spatial segregation. We sometimes seem to perceive a little gradient, opposite gradients in response density. But clearly, it's not segregated, and it's quite different from the olfactory bulb. So that basically means that there's no anatomical constraint on the convergence of processing channels from the bulb to this area DP. Yeah, that's quantified. Okay, so then in DP, we just then looked at responses to odors. This is calcium imaging. And usually find that different odors evoke really different activity patterns. So correlations are low in any case. The individual cells are not more, but also not less selective than the mitral cells. So in a sense, what happens here is that we get a transformation of one order representation into another, and both are combinatorial. What I have to say here is that when this data was taken, we did not have cell type markers yet in this cortical area. So this is basically all cell types lumped together. What is possible is that certain cell types are more selective and others are less selective. So we do not really know how selective the principal neurons are in this area. Now we have a cell type marker, and we can do these experiments, but I don't know the outcome yet. DP is the zebrafish homolog of olfactory cortex, yeah. So it's not nicely layered and so on, but all the experiments we've done so far that indicate that the canonical circuit of olfactory cortex is consistent with the DP circuit. Okay. So what are the transformations? And one experiment we did, and it had been asked before. This is actually what you asked. One experiment that had long been proposed in order to look for convergence of glomerular processing onto higher order neurons is to do mixture experiments. But for this to be meaningful, we would first have to know what happens at the level of mitral cells. And that we did by electrophysiology a number of years ago. So there we found that a mitral cell can respond, that responds to one odor and responds to another odor, usually responds to the mixture in a way as if only one of the two odors was present. And that is true not only for responses that are sort of opposite sign, excitatory or inhibitory, but even for responses that are different only in the time course of the response, you see this dominance in most cases. And then we repeated, just to make sure, we repeated this experiment using calcium imaging. So this is now from mitral cells and responses to one odor, the other one, the mixture. And again, there's usually dominance of one component over the other. And
is that artificial? Would you just titrate the concentration? There's no reason why it should. You made art when my glasses on. It's tiresome and arginine.
Yeah.
Okay, but you made them some fixed concentration, right?
Yes, in that case, they are.
There's no reason that you should expect the receptor.
That's true, yeah, but we know that some.
Yeah.
So at this concentration, we know from all those past experiments that some glomeruli would more strongly respond to this, and others more strongly respond to that odor. And the same for the mitral cells. Well, it's possible that there is sort of competitive or other interactions at the receptor neuron level or at the receptor itself. But then you would expect interactions that give you that would not allow you to reconstruct at the input level the activity patterns by a simple superposition. Then you would get nonlinear effects there. And we have not observed this. Others have observed it in other species using other odors, so it's possible. But at least with these odors, we have no evidence for it.
This is a steady state.
This is actually the raw calcium signal here. So it's not really the steady state. That's just the raw calcium signal. And we are looking... Pardon? Yeah, so the time course here is not very meaningful. And we have actually quantified here only the average calcium signal. And so this is not deconvolved. And here it's quantified in such a way that a signal that is similar to the response to order 1 gets a 0. Something that is similar to order 2 gets a 1. And then you can look at this in this metric and see that the responses to the mixture really cluster around 0 and 1. So the response is similar to one of the components. And then we looked at this in this area DP, and then see all sorts of different effects. So here, for example, is a cell that responds not to the components but to the mixture. This is the opposite, and many responses are sort of intermediate between the two component responses. So here's actually inhibition excitation, and this is somewhere in between. And that is something that is not consistent with mitral cell responses. And in fact, most of them fall in between the component responses here. So here we have responses that are clear, mixture responses that are clearly different from the bulb. And that's And based on those mixture responses, it would be difficult to reconstruct the component responses. So it seems that we are losing component information here, but generate responses that are mixture specific. And basically, what I've shown you here is just consistent with what Richard Axel's lab saw in rats piriform cortex. Very similar results. Okay, so then we went on and looked a bit more how these inputs are integrated in the cells and did whole cell recordings from those DP neurons. And then we saw that in essentially all neurons, all odors would evoke some kind of little depolarization. Interesting to note, this depolarization is usually quite transient. The mitral cell odor response would go on for much, much longer time. And only for a few odors and cells, we found supra-threshold responses here. So the question is then, what is this? Oh, wrong slide, actually. Yeah. So the question then was, what decides whether the depolarization becomes supra-threshold or not? And one possibility is that this is just the amount of excitation that the cell receives. So if it gets convergent inputs from several channels, you could imagine that activating some of those channels may not be enough. You really have to activate most of those channels in order to drive that cell to spike threshold. But there could, of course, be more than that, and that is inhibition. And you haven't seen it, but inhibitory currents are usually very strong in those cells. So it could be really the balance between excitation and inhibition. And if both of those inputs are quite strong, then this balance may actually clamp the membrane potential to a certain value that depends on the odor. So to check for that, you can just inject current into the cell make it fire spontaneously, and then apply the same odor stimulus again that would normally evoke a little depolarization. And in that case now, it actually gives you hyperpolarization. So really, it's a balance between excitation and inhibition that is usually strong enough to pretty much clamp the membrane potential to a certain value. So if that change, so to get a super threshold response, therefore, you needed a shift in this balance in order to make it super threshold. So that would tell us then that the cells in this DP area do not just integrate inputs from a particular combination of glomerular of mitral cell outputs by convergent excitatory inputs, but there must be at least one other pathway, and this is probably oversimplified. There are probably more and also recurrent inhibitory pathways that converge onto the same cell in order to achieve a balance between excitatory and inhibitory inputs. And only if the combinations are correct, the membrane potential would be clamped to a value that is supra-threshold and then fire action potentials. So what could this this readout do for us? One is obvious. It can detect combinations of active mitral cells and therefore form representations of odor objects, meaning odors or combinations of odors that activate particular combinations of mitral cells. Yeah? Right. We have this. I showed us a slide before you came that we have evidence that these recurrent connections exist, so we can see them in electrophysiology. But just for simplicity, they are not in this picture. That's true. The second thing is that by this combination of excitatory and inhibitory inputs, this would also allow the downstream area to actually detect inhibition across those mitral cells. So this cell should have a higher chance of firing if the input channels to the inhibitory pathway get actually inhibited. And since the spontaneous firing rate of the mitral cells is not negligible, it's something like 8 hertz or so, then so this could read out also inhibitory responses of mitral cells. And that could be useful because we know that those actually convey quite a bit of information. Yeah. Okay. So this would be the short form of the DP area. What we can now do is speculate more about what this could do, like the recurrent connectivity is likely important. Feed forward and feedback inhibition is strong and probably separate from each other. It could have different functions that we may be able to dissociate in the future. So this is something that will keep us interested in the future. Okay. So now I would have some data about general adoption, but nothing really that gives us insights in the olfactory system yet. It's more propaganda slides of what you can do with general adoption, and I think we've seen those today.
So I had a question about stuff this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, one thing you mentioned was that you somehow felt that it wasn't an attractive network, and then there was this sort of comment that was both attractive, meaning that I think if you had an input, which is a feedback input, I couldn't even read the board from this point anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have an external input, so you still could have an attractive network, you just need an external field.
I mean, it's, yeah.
But also, my impression was that only a very few neurons would be activated by each odor. So do you have a sense of what the capacity of the model was? Because you mentioned like thousands of neurons, and you only were trying to store a very few states. And maybe it's actually, the question is whether it's an appropriate representation, because the capacity may be very, very small. Maybe all states give you a high degree of correlation.
So on average, we see that an odor activates maybe 5% of the nitro cells in the total bulb.
Yeah.
And out of those, probably a small. It's hard to put numbers on that. I would say, but. Yes, that's right. Yeah. So. Granule and PG cells. On yeah. So
you have very strong correlated states and you do the learning move correctly, then it's not just not scientific learning, but another learning move.
So maybe I should dissociate a few things here. One is the network model that we constructed had direct inhibitory connections between the mitro cells and no inhibitory neurons, which is a major simplification, of course. And we have not applied, there's no learning rule and basically no rule at all to by which we made those connectivities. But this network also does not show this discrete changes in the output states. So this network is therefore not suited to look at the abrupt pattern transitions. So the real olfactory bulb there must be something different in there. And where those transitions come from is hard to say. It's theoretically possible that these transitions are actually present already at the level of input patterns, but very small. And what the network then does is amplify those. And that is in turn again what one of those networks that we had in the model would do. Remember there is this.
We get this from nonlinearity.
Slide disappeared. Anyway, no, it's here. Yeah.
This is
the result. So, this.
what's the connections L, right?
So this is the input.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, connectivity matrix.
That's inside the bracket. I think it was outside the bracket. Because that works on the rate. Yeah? The bracket turns your X into the rate. Yeah?
That's true.
If you want to, maybe we put minus here.
That's convention how to define that. Yeah. So, it's possible that if you have if you have already step functions in the input, so that some inputs are highly correlated, do not get decorrelated a lot, and then there comes a step where the correlation may be a little less. And this would get more decorrelated. So if you have sort of steps in the correlation in the inputs, those would, if they are within this range, would be amplified by a network like this. And that could be one reason why you observe that in the output, but not the input. There are other reasons. Then there's specific connectivity could somehow do this. Attractor networks in general could somehow do this. What is the right solution? We don't know.
What happens? Do you get a transient and goes to this stays there?
I cannot answer that question. We have never done that. I simply cannot answer it. The only data that I know, I think where I could make some statements about this is from Gilles Laurent's lab in insects, where they did that.
And
this is, yeah, but there are previous papers also. There's also work from Mark Stopfer's lab. Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah. But zebrafish, the natural habitat of zebrafish is very slow or even still waters. So in India and Bangladesh, flooded rice fields would be a habitat. But there you have... I guess you can have odor plumes, but they change in time very, very slowly. So I think the temporal variation in the stimulus would mainly come from the fish swimming itself, going from to different locations. If that is correct, you could just measure swimming behavior of those fish to estimate at what, and they often swim in bursts. So they swim and then they glide and stand a little bit, and then you know this from watching fish in an aquarium. And maybe that is what then defines the temporal structure of the olfactory input.
It depends
on the spatial distribution and then, yeah. How far they swim and so on. Yeah. But to my knowledge, that's not known for the environment of zebrafish. Most of work on those plume structures is done in turbulent environments because that's much more interesting, but does not seem to apply to the habitat of zebrafish.
So, for something you can prove, or generally, if you can make an inference that's very broad, lots of non-zero elements, and turn it into one that's very sparse.
Actually, the output is not much sparser than the input. That was before the feedback, yeah. So if you just threshold, then of course you sparsen more and more as you increase the threshold. But this with this recurrent network, the threshold is actually not high. It's actually very low. Yeah, and then the output is basically not sparsened, almost not sparsened. Pardon? The connectivity is sparse, that's right. Yeah, the connectivity is sparse.
The input states represent the measured states, and those could be highly correlated, but then the network turns them into outputs that are very uncorrelated.
That are less correlated, yeah.
So again, I mean, Craig, we just use the learning rule where we force things states, that were rather orthogonal, you know, that fixed ones, and then the states you. Well, it's almost like we're taking each of the inputs and we kind of branch that, and then use those as the output, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are various rules that you can apply to construct a network, and then you can even get, you can get perfectly decorrelated outputs. But that, for that to work, you have to have prior knowledge about the inputs and design the network. And that's exactly what we did not want to do. So knowing the inputs, there's straightforward ways to decorrelate the outputs. But what we wanted to treat the situation where we have no prior knowledge about the inputs, because in the olfactory world it's not clear what kind of inputs an animal will see during its life, and so therefore we were looking for something that decorrelates just any input. And the other thing was, we just started off with random networks like this, and then found that they decorrelate. So we were thinking that perhaps we have to apply learning rules or anything to optimize it. But then we were surprised to see that this random network by itself does a decorrelation.
Yeah, I mean, just to get out of any, I don't know if it sounds, but numerically, it's not, you sure it's not a finite size effect? You need to make bigger networks.
As the network size increases, the average effect is about the same, I would say. But as network size increases, you basically get more reliable decorrelation. If you have a small network and you take random patterns as inputs, you may find some that actually come out more correlated and others that come out less correlated, and those are more frequent. So if you on average you get a decorrelation, but you get these outliers. And as network size increases, you at some point get no outliers anymore. That's the main effect you see. But I would say from our experience, so numerically we did not see really that the average decorrelation depends a lot on network size.
Close to each other, and the output is, if the output, therefore they're apart. Right?
No, it's not. I would think.
Tends to push. So if your inputs are close to this line, it pushes them apart. Right?
Yeah.
How is it different from that?
Okay, two things. First of all, I should probably mention that what we looked at was in a regime of not strong coupling. So coupling coefficients were always smaller than one. That's one thing. For stronger coupling coefficients, it's known that you can, in inhibitory networks, get group winner take all effects and so on. And that is a different regime.
You're right, it has to be less than, but I mean, it has to be close to one.
So, and then for this effect relies on the feedback of this being different to the different cells. Maybe that's just an illustration. So what you have is a distribution of responses to two stimuli that is correlated, that you feed into this network. It gets passed through the nonlinearity, gets thresholded, and therefore partially decorrelated, and then is fed back into the network. And it works for any kind of feedback that gives you a stable state. So it works for inhibitory plus mixed inhibitory and excitatory feedback. If you have only excitatory feedback, the network would not be stable. If you add a global inhibitory drive onto it, then to make it stable again, it would still work. So it's not, it's for all stable networks.
And mathematically, what gives you a stable network here?
Yeah.
Well, you could imagine, you could imagine a set of feedback connection waves that can give you a sequence.
But for random connectivity? Yes.
No, without simulation. I mean,
for random matrix, it's not very helpful. I look at the equation, I forget about the representation. Because L is a random matrix, right?
Mm-hmm.
A random matrix only is many dimensions. So we know what the spectrum of random matrix is. But even my semicircle law. So you can find the maximum eigenvalue just from the statistics of the random matrix.
Yeah. And hopefully it's not the game of this one.
Yeah,
so that's one. That's a really stable. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
For up to a certain variance and mean of this random matrix element, there can be really no
positive eigenvalue. That's, yeah, so the eigenvalues are all within the unit circle. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, this looks a lot like a Hopfield network, right?
It's not symmetric. Yeah.
Waves,
right.
Then it would be a Hopfield network.
Yes.
Which is guaranteed to have stable states.
Oh, no.
But.
It's not guaranteed that you don't overload it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a stable state.
The free energy drones, this thing, only just one of the spaces before there. So,
what Martin derived here and I could not explain it to you now, I have to say. But what he derived is a heuristic criterion to define stability that he then verified with numerical simulations. And that's came basically was matching. So by that criterion, he can define matrices that give you stable states. And he looked only those that give you stable states and not the others.
So is it true that there would be some wave matrices that wouldn't give you stable states?
Yes. For purely inhibitory networks, I don't know. But for mixed inhibitory excited, definitely. For the inhibitory alone, I don't know. Maybe. I should say the weights are all the same. It's just the assignment to the in the placements in the matrix are. So the weights are all the same values. It's uniform weights, but just the assignment in the matrix is random.
Okay. So numerically, all the non-zero weights
are the same. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and then so then you get this feedback, And this feedback pattern is by definition less correlated. So those two feedback patterns are less correlated because they went through the threshold and fed back into the network. And then an important effect is that the different cells here in the network get different inputs. And in a two-neuron model like this, you simply cannot apply this. So it is not possible to compare this to a just two network model. Basically, if you have just two neurons, no, I don't see how that would make sense.
But if we're excitatory interactions, then mm-hmm. the would be more correlated. Like if I go to the same circuit,
well, and the inputs would also be excitatory. Yeah. Then I would expect that both neurons just hit the maximum firing rate at some point.
You tend to increase the correlation in the output.
Yeah.
Right? Because.
But this is, and I suspect you're also looking at channel correlations, right? You look at the correlation of response.
What input you give, the output is further
yeah.
out in that
what,
direction.
What is on these axes? The response of neuron 1.
This is X1.
And this is
X2.
And X is the response of neuron 1.
Yeah. So if you put it, and you can also plot on here the input, H1, H2. So whatever H1, H2 you give for a mutually mm-hmm. excitatory network, this eigenmode has
okay,
more
yeah,
gain,
but
and so it moves further out. In mutually inhibitory network, it goes out this way. So
okay,
it
but yeah.
less correlated.
But here you're looking at the responses, at the correlations
yeah.
between the activity of the individual neurons. And here we're looking at the correlations between the population activities. Oh, so. That's right. Yeah. So that's a biological question, and there's probably some learning effect in the olfactory bulb going on. Two examples. One is what you mentioned on long time scales. Adult neurogenesis can change the networks in the olfactory bulb because new interneurons are integrated, and this integration depends on odor experience. Exactly in what way it changes the function of those networks is I guess, still unclear. And there's been one other experiment done by Don Wilson, where he simply applied one odor for a long period, 50 seconds, as far as I remember. And then he observes in the preformed cortex, after some 10 or 20 seconds, a sudden change in the response of the preformed cortex neuron that he recorded. And then he went back to the olfactory bulb and looked at if a long stimulus like this changes the tuning curve of mitral cells. And in fact, it does. So what it did is if you have a mitral cell and this is a tuning curve, and you then use this odor and apply it for 50 seconds, the tuning curve will have a bump here. So there's something that you can see in the olfactory bulb, but for this effect, it's not clear if it actually occurs in the olfactory bulb, because it could be that the actual synaptic plasticity occurs in the cortex. And then the feedback from cortex to bulb is what leads to this change in the tuning curve. But yes, it's likely that this that the circuits are somehow adapted based on experience, and that could change the or adjust the preprocessor depending on changes in the environment. That's true. So back to that. Just to complete this, so what the cells get as an input is a combination of this external input and this decorrelated input. And if the connectivity here is sparse, the variance in this feedback input can be relatively large. If the input now is dense, and by dense I mean that the total synaptic weights are kept constant. So here now you have more synaptic weights, but each individual one is lower, then the feedback variance is also lower. And then the total variance of the input patterns to those cells would be here more dominated by the input, meaning less decorrelated, and up here it's more dominated by the feedback, meaning more decorrelated. That's the basic idea. And if you then so this would work only if you consider a population of neurons, and we are always considering patterns across the population. So with two neurons, I don't know how much sense that would make. I guess it's true. Yeah. No. I mean, you can measure a variance with two elements. That's true. So it should. Yeah.
You're not decorrelation here. The point was that two nearby inputs become more different.
Nearby. I'm not talking about if the response of this cell to a bunch of odors becomes more different from the response of this cell to the same bunch of odors. So that would be channel decorrelation. What I'm interested in is if the response across this population to odor 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, if these population activity patterns become more decorrelated.
What is this space?
What are the axes? This? Exactly. This is the intensity of the input in response to odor 1. This is the intensity of inputs in response to odor 2. So this axis is a stimulus 1, stimulus 2, and it's not cell 1, cell 2. It's stimuli. And here it's corresponding output cells. Not the output cells, but also stimuli, of course. It can be quite counterintuitive because usually one looks at channels and not at patterns in most applications. It's true, yeah. As I said, mixed excitation inhibition would also work, but as long as it doesn't explode. So with mixed feedback, you would say you randomly shoot out some but boost others. That's true. And it works because the feedback is more decorrelated than the input. If you would not have the thresholding here, then it would not necessarily work.
Well,
It would actually not work. It would definitely not work. Mm-hmm. It would not work. That is the essential component here. That's sort of the seed. So the thresholding here is the seed, because it gives you a little bit of a decorrelation, and the feedback then is the amplification of this seed decorrelation. Actually, Martin mathematically showed that any linear system does not achieve a decorrelation on average. It may achieve a decorrelation for a particular set of stimuli. So this is what you get when you train a linear system to decorrelate selected stimuli. But if you take the complete universe of inputs, on average, it never achieves a decorrelation. Which is quite a, I think, a statement, because linear systems have been trained for, and that is not only for pattern but also for channel decorrelation, and linear systems have been used a lot to do channel decorrelation and work fine for inputs that they were trained on, but I'm not aware of some paper showing that it, on average it actually comes out, yeah. Hmm. Pardon?
One system, so yeah, all, I mean, correlation is always defined with respect to a certain set of stimuli, right? You have to
the
average of
something.
And all these correlation models for visual receptive fields. That's why people measure the correlation functions of measuring images.
To the right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that should also apply here to the notion of really what you say is that it's robust against the choice of this ensemble of stimuli.
So this with this nonlinearity would on average decorrelate. Any? Pardon?
On average, over what? Which ensemble?
Any kind of input pattern. Actually, strictly mathematically speaking, it's that shows a Gaussian intensity distribution. And then Martin just looked for counterexamples, found a few, but it in so numerical simulations indicate that it also holds for a broad class of stimuli that are not Gaussian distributed. So three is not good enough.
If it's not this, I don't care.
Three is not good enough.
Well, it might be, but you have to put some input in there, you know, mentally I can understand. I don't understand what you mean by pattern. If you have the response, you know, let's look at input space, okay? You have an input space. One, I guess it means A, but whatever, A. Is by pattern, you mean a particular vector. Like, that's one pattern,
mm-hmm.
and that's another pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you want this pattern to have less overlap with this pattern
mm-hmm.
once you go to the output space, X1,
xt, okay? So you wanted to take this vector stimulus 1 and this vector stimulus 2 and make them less alike.
Mm-hmm.
So you want s1 to be here, and you want s2 to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So this network that I just drew does that. And if you make this excitatory, it makes them closer together. Because it amplifies this mutually inhibitory network, amplifies this mode, which makes these two further apart.
But this one, so.
And.
So, okay, now I'm not sure I can give you a strong argument, but this would always drive one of those neurons towards the axis, right?
No.
This, I mean, the inhibitory.
Well, in this case, this S1 is along the eigenmode, so it doesn't change, or it gets longer. And this one, it's, you know, sorry, other way. This gets shorter, and this component gets amplified, so it moves further this way. So they get less correlated. They get further apart. Now, what you might say is if I had my two inputs of this, one here and one here, that this network would then make them closer to each other because it amplifies this in this direction and puts those two modes closer together. So is that what you're saying? That it doesn't always work because it depends on the stimulus? I don't know.
So I'm confused because this is negative now.
Yeah, okay.
And I can...
Right, so that doesn't work. All right, so if you restrict yourself to positive inputs, so we're no longer a linear network, but you restrict yourself to positive inputs, then this guy will always decorrelate. This mutually inhibitory network will always decorrelate. And this will always increase the correlation.
This is, in fact, something that we considered along the way, that's true,
mm-hmm.
that
well, except that I've made the gains less than one.
Yeah.
I've made the gain less than one here, so it doesn't run away. But yeah, okay, I'm making a soft version of winner take all.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yeah. That's what I was trying to say, that this variance in the feedback pattern is important. And if you have two neurons, you can not get a variance in the feedback from one to the other. That is so essential for this mechanism to work is that is that the different neurons feedback the inhibition to different neurons in the network. And if you just have one, then you cannot. So this neuron can feedback only to one other neuron, and that does not. So therefore the variance effect cannot. There can be no variance, and that is the important effect. As a consequence of this, because each neuron feeds back to different other neurons in the network, each one receives different inputs from other sets of neurons, and that just cannot work in a two neuron network. So that's the other thing.
One thing that might be helpful is
if you have.
You could just draw an input space and tell me, and basically draw a picture of how this network. This network is just a one-to-one mapping of A123 to alpha123.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if there's some graphical way of just representing that input-output relationship for some set of the input space, that might be that might help to create an intuition about what this does. See what I mean?
Yeah. So the input could be basically any n-dimensional vector, n being the number of channels here.
Input space, A1, 2, 3, and show me for a set of A1, 2, and 3, maybe a slice through that space, what happens at the output? But in this, a mutually inhibitory network, you can write it down as, it takes any input and moves the output away, it amplifies this eigenmode.
Mm-hmm.
So, there must be some corresponding picture that tells me how the inputs move in the output space that would give a very intuitive sense for what the network does. And you can do that for, maybe for.
So this is just an example. So this is inputs, two inputs. The inputs were actually much bigger than this. This is just a subset of this, and this is the outputs. This is a region where you see the differences here quite clearly now.
Is this the
blue level is the active.
Is this the A vector in a very high dimensional space?
Yeah. So this is just. So this could be a one dimensional vector, and this could be one dimensional.
Yeah, but I was thinking about A1, A2. I'm talking about a very low dimensional space.
Ah, this we have.
My brain doesn't make sense of these, random, lists of.
Okay, in a very low dimensional space.
Yeah.
I think it's just. I wouldn't know how to. Because
you three.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So for those. Is there. Okay.
And we'll get some vector field.
Yeah, okay.
How the network has changed the input to the output.
Okay. I know what you mean. No, I don't have that. And we have never plotted anything like that. Okay, so you want to really see.
The cool thing about now, in your network is that you can describe it as eigenmodes. And you can say,
you can understand just very simply what happens.
Yeah.
To gain along an eye.
Yeah, yeah, okay. For you, now I see what you mean. You want to plot this in a two or maybe three dimensional space that you can
see yeah. What happens.
Okay. No, we've never done that, and also a problem with the eigen.
Well, look, Hopfield is the Hopfield network isn't
yeah.
Linear either. But one of the beautiful things about the Hopfield network is that you can draw a picture that looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes and yeah. These input positions and.
It moves you toward an output that is close to one of these effects. So there's a very simple mental picture that you can make.
So I think that's what I need in order to understand. So my sense is that you're getting at something like this. It's tending to you know, pull these things toward like a random, you know, I can imagine in this space, in this high dimensional space, this random network kind of creates a bunch of like energy minima that the inputs get attracted to. Right?
No, I don't think so. Because at least in the limit of and well.
Isn't that what you're saying?
Maybe, sucked
toward particular points, and they're not dynamically self-sustaining points like in a Hopfield attractor, but they are attractors in the sense that if your input is anywhere near them, they get sucked in. In the output space.
If you have, yeah, probably for networks with finite neurons, probably yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. The mathematical theory looks at infinite numbers of neurons, mm-hmm. so that would mean that any small difference you have would be amplified just a little bit. A larger difference would be amplified a bit more. If the correlation is zero, it would not be amplified anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you have this in a
imagine we have two of my imaginary attractors. If you have two inputs that are close to this, they actually be closer.
It would not do
nothing.
That's right.
So it's kind of what you drew.
Yeah, it's true, but except for this here, that if it's very close, it would snap to this point.
Yeah.
This is what made me think. So in the limit of infinite number of neurons, this should not happen. But if the number of neurons is not infinite, then it probably does happen. Yeah. So probably yes. Probably yes. But in some way, this is. So would this, if these are just, if this is just like you drew it, would this on average give you a decorrelation?
I don't know. It's different for different inputs. So in this range of inputs, there would be an increased correlation because they would be sucked.
Exactly.
And in a sense, this is a little bit like, it's a little bit, I'm blanking on it right now. It's a little bit like categorical perception, right? In speech, for example. If you look in the space of vowel sounds, formative F1 and F2, you have the ideal vowel sound here, like E. And any sound
in between
gets in here, all get detected as E.
and any sound that's here you detect it as mm-hmm. boom, and anything at the boundary tends to either be here
mm-hmm. or, yeah, or there. Yeah.
So it, yeah, but is this like,
does this on average give a decorrelation? I don't know.
The interesting thing, though, is that if this is true, this random network just sort of throws these like I don't know what to call them, pseudo attractors down mm-hmm. in space randomly. Right?
Yeah, but this would work, as I said, only for finite number of neurons, and then the mathematics doesn't work anymore. So,
but with so this number, it's essentially so peppered with that local minima that it.
You would get have a continuum of local minima, I guess.
Right.
And that's.
So wait. So you're saying that you're, but mathematically, your network doesn't work for small numbers of neurons or finite numbers?
The theory can be solved only in the limit of infinite number of neurons. And
in that case, you get decorrelation. But you're saying this picture doesn't work because in the limit of infinite numbers of neurons.
So I can just not say if in a limit of when you have finite numbers of neurons, this would happen if this would give the on average a decorrelation, and if this were so if so, and that is sort of important for me to have an idea if this is the same mechanism. Mm-hmm. But in principle, actually,
well,
it must be something like this because the with a finite number of neurons, you can change the output of some neurons and nothing would happen because you have a threshold and you get sort of finite effects when you cross thresholds. Mm-hmm. That is, so yeah, could be. So there must be something that you can change in the input that does not give you an effect on the output. Or just not a big effect on is that true? Because you're not crossing a threshold, and if you cross the threshold, then you get abrupt changes in the output. Mm-hmm. So that could be.
Well, so I think it would be really fun to see sort of a low-dimensional representation mm-hmm. of what's happening. Like, mm-hmm. I think it would give some intuition. I mean, one thing is you can also, you know, so one thing when you learn things about top-field attractors is there's this energy surface and can have these local minima, right, that are the attractors. And when you actually program a hot field network with this connection matrix C, CI, CJ, where C is the state you're trying to learn, that mm-hmm. basically gives you a really deep energy mm-hmm. minimum at that state, right? If you take a random network, I bet that you end up having sort of
something like this, mm-hmm.
kind of like this, but it's sort of like random.
Mm-hmm.
Which is almost like what you drew in your picture, right? You were kind of drawing a 2D representation of this idea, right? This mm-hmm. picture that you drew, the one you said you didn't really mm-hmm. like, but that's mm-hmm. kind of what you were drawing.
Yeah.
From, right?
Yeah. But I mean that was experimental data, and this is now the simulation in theory.
But this energy surface is going to give you a force that's going to move your input. It depends on where the slope is going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting network.
Yeah. I have to say I don't. I don't understand the mathematics good enough to think quickly. So the mathematicians
insist at heart. And so this, the mathematics leaves me really unsatisfied. What I want is more like that.
I see. Okay. Okay. The mathematicians, yeah, the mathematicians can take me through this, and I can follow what they say.
While they're saying.
But I cannot. I must not look left and right.
What's that?
So certain effects cannot be done with two neurons.
It's
mm-hmm.
possible
to do it with. Well, on the plane, it's something that helps people get the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But there are really high dimensional things, so we have to fail.
There should still be a way of explaining it to somebody that they can understand. Even if you take a slice through high dimension, I don't know how to do it, but, you know. This is the supplementary material. I bet that's one of the more mathematical things they've published.
Yes, there's some experimental data in there to justify.
Okay, cool. I enjoyed it, Brenner.
Okay, I'll pass that on to Martin Wiechert, the guy who actually did it.